A Reckoning for the Catholic Church, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The Vatican this week tries to address sexual abuse.
What's unprecedented about it is that never before has the Pope summoned the presidents of the world's bishops' conferences to Rome to talk about abuse.
Also, the freedom of driving a car in Saudi Arabia.
This car empowers women. A huge burden has just been lifted, and you can take control.
Plus, an aspiring teacher from Mexico gets an Oscar nomination for her first role.
And now I have discovered that by making a movie, you can also teach people many things.
And lightsabers get some respect in the fencing world. We'll explain ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. This is a big week for the Catholic Church. Pope Francis is gathering his bishops at the Vatican to discuss the clergy sex abuse crisis. The summit comes as Francis faces increased pressure. It also comes just days after the Vatican defrocked the former Archbishop of Washington, D.C., Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, after McCarrick was found guilty of sex crimes. Tomorrow, 12 survivors will be meeting with organizers of the Pope's summit in Rome. Phil Salviano is one of those survivors. He's an activist against clergy sex abuse in Boston. With him is Anne Doyle, the co-director of the research group Bishop Accountability. We reached them both in Rome. Let's start with you, Phil. You're one of 12 survivors of clergy sexual abuse who will be meeting tomorrow with organizers of Pope Francis' summit. What do you plan to say?
Well, I've been thinking about that a great deal, actually. I think that one of the points that I want to make is how important it is for the names of abusers, names of bishops that have protected abusers as well, to be released by the Vatican. That not only helps to set a record in terms of, you know, what are the numbers that we're talking about here, and do the Vatican numbers compare with the numbers that we've been tracking at Bishop Accountability. But the other thing, for the healing of survivors, it's really, really important that they're able to see that the men that have sexually assaulted them are starting to get recognition for those sorts of deeds. And I really don't know what the format of the meeting is yet. I don't know how long it's going to last. I don't know if we're going to be sitting in a circle like it's a big SNAP support group or what. But if there's additional time, I may also talk a little bit about my personal experiences as a child with this priest, David Hawley, who assaulted me over and over when I was 11 and 12 years old.
And that was when you were growing up in Douglas, Massachusetts.
That's right.
And SNAP means the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. I want to turn to you, Anne, and a reminder for our listeners, you're co-director of the research group Bishop Accountability. And at this meeting of bishops and other leaders on Thursday, it's being called unprecedented. What's unprecedented about it?
Well, what's unprecedented about it is that never before has the Pope summoned the presidents of the world's bishops' conferences to Rome to talk about abuse. But the fact that it's a novelty doesn't mean that it's going to have historic impact. The Vatican has downplayed expectations for this meeting. The problem is, though, that the Catholics around the world are outraged and they're demanding accountability. So they want this meeting to not only be a first in terms of its organization, but also to really begin to solve this crisis. It's been a long time, and the Vatican and the Pope have yet to enact meaningful reform.
And what would you like to see come out of this meeting that would indicate to you that they're really serious about reform?
I would like to see a universal one strike and you're out policy. The U.S. bishops have something resembling that, but they are the only bishops' conference in the world to have that kind of policy. Every other bishops' conference we have studied in Mexico, in the Philippines, in Colombia, in the Congo, in Italy, have rules that allow guilty priests to return to ministry. That has to stop.
Phil, what are you looking for to come out of this summit?
I'd like to see them start to get serious about mandated reporting. And that means that when a priest is caught molesting a child, that it's not handled internally. It's reported outside to civil authorities. because that would show two things. First of all, that they're no longer going to be protecting these men. And secondly, that they'll start to treat it as a serious crime, which it is, as opposed to a moral failing that they need to pray over. For many, many years, the Vatican has used the solution of prayer as a way to solve this problem, and I think that those days really need to come to an end. These are crimes against children that we're talking about, not moral failures, and what needs to be done is these crimes need to be reported to civil authorities.
And when I look at this summit, I'm trying to sort out, is Pope Francis trying to get, is this a PR thing for Catholics and others around the world to realize he's taking this issue seriously, or is he trying to persuade his own church and bishops and other church leaders to take it seriously?
I think the Pope's real audience is the public, and I think he's trying to create the illusion of taking action without, in fact, enacting any meaningful change.
You sound skeptical about Pope Francis' intention. Why?
I'm skeptical because recently he has been saying that what's needed is a cultural change. That may be true, but that's not where we start. First, Pope Francis changes canon law, and he can let the hearts and minds follow. We don't wait until these bishops have a conversion experience to realize that there has to be no tolerance for priests who rape and assault children. The Pope can put the rule in place first and let the cultural change happen later.
Phil, you get the last word. What do you think survivors of clergy sex abuse need most right now out of this big summit in the Vatican?
I think what survivors are looking for the most is to feel that they're being believed, they're being respected, and that the pain and the embarrassment of coming forward and speaking about their childhood abuse has not been a wasted effort. Because what we all want is to ensure that the types of experiences that we had as children are not going to continue to be experienced by other Catholics. And this is not only in the United States, but all over the world. And so we're hoping that this summit will lead to some concrete action on the part of the Vatican that will not only reveal who some of these abusers are, reveal the names of some of the bishops that have been protecting the abusers, but also have some actions such as mandated reporting, better screening of seminarians, and so on. If those things happen, then I think survivors will feel that their speaking out has been worthwhile.
Phil Saviano is a well-known activist and survivor of clergy sex abuse. He worked with the Boston Globe to expose the cover-up by Cardinal Bernard Law in 2001. We've also been speaking with Anne Doyle. She's the co-director of the research group Bishop Accountability. They've been speaking with us from Rome. I want to thank you both.
Thank you, Carol.
South African runner Caster Semenya has been making headlines for a decade as one of the world's best track athletes. This week, she's back in the news for a different reason. Semenya is challenging controversial rules about how much testosterone women athletes can have in their bodies and still compete as women. The international governing body for track and field, the IAAF, wants new rules to regulate athletes with hyperandrogenism. Semenya has the condition, which causes naturally high levels of testosterone, and her case is before the Court of Arbitration for Sport all this week. Katrina Karkazes is an anthropologist and bioethicist and co-author of Testosterone, an Unauthorized Biography. I asked her what exactly the IAAF's rules would entail.
The International Olympic Committee has had similar regulations in the past, and what they do is place a ceiling or a threshold on women's natural testosterone levels, so not doping. And women who exceed the threshold are required to lower their testosterone via medical interventions in order to keep competing. And she's challenging those regulations as being unfair.
But there was a case back in 2014 involving Indian Olympic runner Dutee Chand that I thought really settled the issue of what they call hyperandrogenism rules.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of confusion among people right now about why this is back in the court. Doody won her case in 2015. What the court said, however, is that it would suspend the regulations for 2 years pending further evidence. So basically, the IAAF at that point had not sufficiently proven their case that women with higher testosterone have a performance advantage. Rather than sort of revisit that case, if you will, with Chand, what the IAAF did was to propose new regulations that only apply to a limited set of events. Doody Chand doesn't participate in those events. It's 400 meter to the mile. And that more or less effectively closed her case and made it inevitable that an athlete participating in those events, like Caster Semenya, would bring forth a challenge and continue the fight against the regulations.
Let's get into the science behind this. First, can you define hyperandrogenism for us?
So hyperandrogenism is a medical term that really means higher than typical testosterone levels in women. As you might imagine, there's no such designation for men, but in the medical world, there is regarding women. And so Caster Semenya was born with a variation that gives her higher than typical testosterone levels. There's actually a very long history of trying to regulate women's eligibility, and these testosterone regulations fall in the footsteps of that decades-long history.
What science is the IAAF basing its rules on?
They have published some work in the intervening 2 years, and I've seen some very heavy and important critiques of one of their main pieces of evidence. So what they've tried to do is correlate women with a range of testosterone, meaning higher versus lower, and to correlate that with athletic performance. The problem with their study is that there were events where they found a higher degree of performance difference, such as pole vault and hammer throw, which they didn't regulate. And in fact, 800 meter was one of the events in track and field that had one of the lowest performance differences. One of the things that people believe is that testosterone almost works like a dose response relationship. If you have a little bit more, you go this many seconds faster. But the science of testosterone and athletic performance doesn't bear that out. Some independent researchers actually got some of those raw data, and what they've charged is that there are actually deep and devastating flaws in both the data that were provided and the analysis of that data such that it should be retracted. So I'm sure that will absolutely be a point of debate in the case.
So is your position that there should be no rules on this?
Yes, that is my view, in large part because in the last case, both sides agreed that this was a regulation that discriminated against women. Where the dispute came in is the degree of performance advantage, and if it was great enough, then perhaps it might merit such discrimination. But the UN, Human Rights Watch, and other ethicists have spoken out about the grave threats to bodily integrity and autonomy to require women to undergo medically unnecessary interventions to compete in the category that they've always competed in. So there's a great deal of suspicion, stigma placed on women who are being challenged without any scientific evidence. Any perceived advantage is exactly that, perceived. One of the things I've argued is that this affects all women athletes because it really creates a kind of policing of women's appearance, women's bodies for signs of what are believed to be high testosterone, and that harms all women athletes.
Katrina Karkazis is co-author of Testosterone, an Unauthorized Biography. You're tuned to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. At the Academy Awards this weekend, there's one surprise film that's getting a lot of attention, Roma, by Mexican director Alfonso Cuarón. It has 10 nominations, and if Roma wins for Best Picture, it would be a first for a foreign language film. A win would also be a first for Netflix, Roma's U.S. distributor. Roma is the story of Cuarón's own middle-class childhood in Mexico City, but told from the point of view of Cleo, one of the family's maids.
Además, ¿cómo lo presentaste? Ay, manita, ¿ya ves cómo te pones? Nada más te estoy jodiendo.
Ya llegaron.
Cleo is played by first-time actress Yalitza Aparicio, and she herself is up for the Best Actress Award. The World's William Troop spoke with her recently.
Yalitza, you had just graduated to become a teacher when you were cast for Roma. With the success of the movie, how has your life changed?
I had just finished my studies to become a teacher. I haven't actually taught yet. This whole adventure started with a casting call in Tlaxiaco, which is where I was born and grew up.
Do you think you're going to go back and be a teacher after the all the hoopla over Roma quiets down?
Well, I'd love to make another movie. I wanted to become a teacher because that's a way to reach a lot of people and educate them. And now I have discovered that by making a movie, you can also teach people many things.
You were doing a photo shoot at the border barrier in Tijuana when you found out that you had received the Oscar nomination. What was your reaction at that moment?
No lo podía creer. Simplemente me solté a llorar.
I could not believe it. I simply broke down crying from all the emotion. I was just hoping that the film would be nominated for Best Picture, and I never expected to see my name included in the Best Actress category and in the company of all these amazing actresses. I think that's why I burst into tears.
How do you feel now that it's been several weeks since you found out about the nomination?
I think I'm still feeling the same. I don't know. I still can't believe that any of this is even possible.
And besides being director Alfonso Cuarón's autobiographical film and a beautiful movie to watch, Roma also touches on a lot of social issues like class and race and ethnicity. When you were doing the film, could you see all of the ramifications?
These were themes that I discovered little by little, since we didn't have a script and we didn't really know how the story would unfold. So every time we film a scene, I could sense some of the issues that were being raised, and it was surprising to me.
I had read that your mother also worked as a domestic worker. How personal was this role for you?
Mi mamá ha sido trabajadora del hogar por mucho tiempo.
Yes, my mother has been a domestic worker for a long time, and that was one of the things that crossed my mind a lot, that with this movie I could honor her as well.
How did your mother react to the movie when she finally watched it?
Pues le gustó mucho la historia.
She liked it a lot, even if there were parts of the film that were scary for her. Like the scene by the ocean where I go into the waves. But she said it was a beautiful story.
You are the first indigenous woman to be nominated for Best Actress. Before this movie, did you think of yourself as an indigenous Mexican woman, or did you just think of yourself as Mexican?
Siempre me he identificado con mis raíces. No sé, crecí...
I've always identified with my roots. I grew up always proud of who I am. People used to say I'm a strange mix between Mixteca and Triqui, but I've always been clear about where I come from.
Siempre tenía presente de dónde venía.
I read that the Roma, the movie, was shown at a film festival, a Zapatista film festival in Chiapas. What was that experience like for you?
Fue una experiencia maravillosa. Ahí es un contexto totalmente diferente.
That was amazing. It was a whole different experience there, like a different world. People there aren't so obsessed with fame or asking you to take pictures with them. After they showed the movie, when the lights came back on, all I could see were people's eyes, because the Zapatistas covered their faces, and all the eyes were red from crying. It was really surprising to see how a movie like this had truly touched their hearts.
Do you feel like you are representing Mexico's indigenous side to the world?
I am just an example of the diversity that exists in Mexico, with our many cultures and our many faces. And that's all.
Yalitza Aparicio is the Oscar-nominated star of the film Roma. She was speaking there with my colleague William Troop. There's another film that's getting a lot of attention, but for different reasons. Berlin, I Love You is a collection of vignettes, each written and directed by different people around the world. Chinese artist Ai Weiwei is one of them. So when the film was released in the U.S. earlier this month, he was surprised to find out his contribution didn't make the cut. The BBC's Carrie Allen has been following this story. I asked her why Ai Weiwei's bit was left out of the film entirely.
Ai Weiwei has had a very difficult relationship with the Chinese authorities for a long period of time now. And I mean, his art is classed as controversial. He doesn't have a presence in mainland China. I mean, his name, for example, if you type it into China's equivalent of Facebook or Twitter, Weibo, his name is outright censored. So the government doesn't like people talking about Ai Weiwei. And he said that the reason that his episode was pulled from this film was because the authorities have put pressure on the film company, saying that if you have connections with this man, you're almost supporting separatism or independence, and you're not supporting the Chinese Communist Party line.
Hmm. It's interesting because this thing, Berlin, I Love You, it's part of this franchise called City of Love, where they make these composite films with contributions from all these directors. And I read that one of the executives with this franchise actually has an office in Shanghai and might make one episode about Shanghai. Could it also be, though, an episode of self-censorship, of simply the interest in the Chinese market itself influencing the producers to make their own choice, even without direct Chinese pressure?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, China is such a huge market. This is a trend, actually, that extends beyond film at the moment, that companies have to be extremely cautious. And they recognize that if they curry favor with the Chinese government, then that will benefit them in the long run.
And there's a related episode. Just last week at the Berlin Film Festival, the latest film by Zhang Yimou, a very famous Chinese filmmaker, was yanked at the last minute. The film's called 1 Second. It's set in the Chinese Cultural Revolution. Should we assume that this is for the similar reasons?
Well, this one was quite surprising because Zhang Yimou has had a very, very close relationship with the government. I mean, he's been kind of, you know, put on a pedestal by the Chinese government as a real kind of pioneer in Chinese film, in showing Chinese film to the West. So his film being pulled was a big surprise. But there is this trend at the moment in China. There's this revitalization of the film industry to basically be setting good examples to people. And so the government is looking more and more to instigate like stronger controls over film and people who are tied to the film industry.
My BBC colleague, Carrie Allen. We've reached out to several people involved with the production of Berlin, I Love You, but did not hear back by airtime. I'm Carol Hills. The day Saudi Arabia started allowing women to drive, this woman insisted on being there.
I'm telling you, honey, I was counting the days. Like, I told my boss, I told my husband, I was like, listen, this day we will be home. I am not traveling.
Saudi women and their changing culture, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, arrived in India today, and he was warmly greeted there by Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The prince's previous stop, Pakistan, where he also got the red carpet treatment. Interestingly, the prince, also known as MBS, is touring the region at a time of heightened tensions between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. In Pakistan, MBS announced a $20 billion investment deal, which the Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan seemed to appreciate.
Saudi Arabia has always been a friend for Pakistan. Saudi Arabia has been a friend when Pakistan has needed friends.
The friendship between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan does go way back. But for his part, the Saudi crown prince put the emphasis on the future.
So we believe that Pakistan is going to be a very, very important country in the coming future. And we want to be sure that we are part of that. So we are waiting for that kind of leadership to partner with and to build a lot of things together.
In the West, MBS and Saudi Arabia may be facing a lot of criticism over the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But the prince's current Asian tour shows the Saudis still have plenty of friends. Before Khashoggi's killing, Saudi Arabia was bent on portraying itself as opening up to change. And the crown prince has tried to cultivate an image as a modernizer. The world's Shirin Jafari wanted to travel to the kingdom to find out what a modernized Saudi Arabia looked like. This week, we get to share her stories with you. But as we're about to hear, it took a lot of work to get there.
2 years ago, I started applying to get a journalist visa. This was way before the, Khashoggi story. This was way before the lifting of the driving ban. So Saudi Arabia at that point was in the news, but not in the same way as it is right now. I was in touch with the spokesperson at the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. And honestly, like, I had emailed that person so many times that I think in the end, they just got so tired of me and they said, just give her the visa. I was just shocked and surprised, honestly. And if you're a journalist and you cover the region and you're given a visa to go report in Saudi Arabia, you're not going to say no. I get to Dubai, and as I hand over my passport, you know, the security agent, she tells me that my visa is not valid and I have to get a new visa. You're talking about something that took me 2 years to get, and I was trying to get that in a day. So it was a nightmare. It was basically a nightmare.
Good afternoon, dear guests. Welcome to King Abdul Aziz International Airport.
But I ended up getting the new visa. I got to the airport, boarded the flight. Finally. I knew from talking to reporters who'd been on the ground that the Saudi government typically issues minders. And they're basically there to make sure that you're not reporting on anything that they feel is too sensitive. Think of it as somebody who isn't like this shady, scary person that you feel uncomfortable with. They're actually, you know, very friendly. They chit-chat and, you know, he joked that we share the same last name and that we're long-lost cousins and that we found each other finally. But the thing is, you're constantly thinking, am I doing anything that could put me in jeopardy? Until last summer, Saudi Arabia was the only country in the world where women couldn't drive. I mean, I had reported on this before, and I did have a good sense that, yes, this is an important moment for women in Saudi Arabia. But to what extent, I had no idea. I meet Sharia Walker at the end of her workday in the parking lot of the bank where she works. And I say to her, listen, I'm a reporter from the U.S. and would you mind if I ride along with you to your home? And she says yes, so we get into the car and this is a private space.
I curse sometimes while I'm driving, so...
The government minder is in a different car behind us. And Sharia Walker does feel more comfortable to talk to me and tell me things that she might not feel comfortable expressing in front of somebody who is an official from the Ministry for Information.
Honestly, I never, not in a thousand years, imagined that one day it would be possible for me to get behind the wheel and drive myself home. The status quo has just been set in place for so long. So I remember even when the royal decree was announced, I was like, yeah, right. That's just another of those, you know, fake news.
And then, so when you found out that it is not fake news.
Oh, my God. I'm telling you, honey, I was counting the days. Like, I told my boss, I told my husband. I was like, listen, this day, we will be home. I am not traveling, you know.
Sharia Walker grew up in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, she told me she comes from a family that couldn't afford a driver. So there are buses and there are taxis, but they're not reliable and they're not clean. For her, it was really a hassle to get from one place to another.
I wanted to drive. I wanted other women to see me. I wanted the men to see me just to kind of... Sorry about that. Just to, I guess, to change that perspective, you know, because I knew that there would be a lot of reluctance from women first, but also from men. And I was honestly, I was so nervous and I was very scared because I was like, I didn't know what to expect when I got on the road. I didn't know if, you know, men would harass me on the road or would they make me uncomfortable, right? Because this car empowers women, right? Now you have the freedom to, if you have an idea and you're like, you know what, let me go to that meeting, or I heard there's a group of, you know, entrepreneurs getting together for whatever, or now you don't have to think about who are you going to contact, how are you going to get there, is it okay, you just get behind your wheel and you do it. I feel like it's just a huge burden has just been lifted, and you could just, you can take control.
Sharia Walker is one confident woman. It's not usual for women in Saudi Arabia to wear colorful abayas, which is like the long robe that women have to wear in public. But Sharia Walker is that woman who is wearing the most colorful abaya you see in Jeddah.
Like I would wait, I would give the right of, you know, the road to whoever's in front of me, or and then I noticed that I'm just there forever. No one would stop for me, and I'm like, the hell with this. So I honked my horn. I'll try not to swear while you're recording. But honestly, like, I haven't encountered any harassment or you know, uncomfortable situations. On the contrary, like, guys honk their horns and they give me a thumbs up. Kids, they're all like waving like this is something they've never seen, you know. So they're like five kids packed up in the car and they're all like peering through the window and waving and like they see a celebrity or something. So it's been quite, my experience has been quite encouraging.
What are some of your specific interests in a car? Like, what do you look for?
Okay. If it was my dream car, I would get a Tesla. But they're very, they're quite expensive still. Maybe a birthday gift.
What's your birthday?
4th of July. So, Independence Day, baby. Independence Day.
So now that the ban has been lifted, what's next? What do women here want to see next?
When we're talking about, like, the idea of women equality, it has to be mainstreamed throughout everything in society. You know, every system that governs the country, they have to take into account how does it affect women. That shift in culture and people and mindset, that takes time.
Are we home?
We're home.
Thank you. That was a really nice ride.
So we get to Sharia Walker's house.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. Thank you very
we
much.
We get out of the car and the government minder is right behind us. The sun is almost set. At that point, he's exhausted too, and he's had a long day. Sometimes I see him messaging his wife and talking to her on the phone. So he's a family man, and he needs to get back home. We end up riding back to my hotel, mostly in silence.
The World's Shirin Jafari reporting in Saudi Arabia. And Shirin joins me now. And Shirin, I got to ask, what would have happened if you'd reported on anything that the minder and the government wasn't happy about?
So, like I said, I was in touch with a couple of journalists before I went to Saudi Arabia, and they told me that I might be deported or even taken in for questioning, and I really didn't want any of that to happen.
So what were the no-go zones, things you simply could not touch on?
I think one major red line for the Saudi government is the case of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. He's the Washington Post columnist who was murdered in Turkey back in October. They're also very sensitive about the arrest of a group of women's rights activists.
What's that about?
Last May, a short time before the driving ban was lifted, about a dozen women's rights activists were rounded up and put in prison. Some of them are still locked up as we talk, and human rights groups are really concerned about them.
We received reports that several activists, including women's rights activists, were tortured, ill-treated, and sexually abused during the first 3 months of their detention.
That's Donna Ahmed. She's with the Amnesty International and she's based in Beirut.
One of the activists was unable to stand properly. Her hands were shaking, and this was in one of the visits that the family saw her in.
Ahmed also told me that at least one of the activists has attempted suicide.
That's incredible. I mean, that's shocking.
Yeah, and Amnesty International and other human rights groups have called for an independent investigation into these arrests, and they've also called for the Saudi government to release them immediately.
What do we know about why these women were rounded up in the first place?
So these are some of the most prominent women's rights activists in Saudi Arabia. They're the people behind the movement that led to the lifting of the driving ban. One of them is Hatun Al-Fassi. She's an academic. She's been fighting for women's rights in Saudi Arabia for a really long time. Another one is Lujain Al-Hathoul. She's been very outspoken about the driving ban. I got in touch with the family of one of these activists and asked them if they're willing to speak with me. And they refused because they said they worry that speaking to the media might make the situation for the activists even worse than what it is right now.
I mean, that makes sense, but what are the actual charges against these activists?
So far, there are no formal charges against them, and none of them has been put on trial. But back in the summer, when they were arrested, Saudi state newspaper ran a smear campaign against them. They accused them of treason and working with foreign countries to undermine the kingdom.
Has the Saudi government said anything about what's going to happen to these women?
When I was in Saudi Arabia, I asked to speak with the Saudi Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, Adel Al-Jubeir. He didn't respond to my request, but he was in Washington, D.C. a couple of days ago, and he said the women's rights activists are going to be put on trial, and the evidence against them will come up in the trial.
Did he give any kind of date of when that trial is going to take place?
He didn't, no. But we'll keep a close eye on those trials if they do come up. And one more thing, Carol, before I go, I just want to point out that the voice we heard in my story, the woman who supports the lifting of the driving ban, that's just one opinion. I met another woman at a local market in Riyadh. Her name is May. She didn't give me her last name. And she told me she doesn't want to drive. Even though the ban has been lifted, she's kept her driver.
Some women, they need... And it's normal, but I don't like. I feel it's, you know, like princess. I have driver. I don't look for parking. I don't clean my car. I don't place petrol. I live 50 years, you know, in one level. Then now everything changing. I can't, you know, I want to feel that I can, you know, live this life.
She's used to what she's used to.
Exactly.
Now, tomorrow, I know you're going to have a different story from Saudi Arabia. What is it?
So tomorrow, I'll report on how the work culture in Saudi Arabia is shifting. As you know, the Saudi economy relies heavily on oil, and the government employs a lot of people using that revenue. But things are starting to shift. The government has realized it can't rely on oil forever. And what that means for the Saudis is that they're starting to work in positions they didn't like before. For example, you know, they're working as baristas, cashiers, sales clerks.
Interesting. So they're starting to do jobs that guest workers used to do in Saudi Arabia.
Exactly.
The World's Shirin Jafari. Thanks so much, Shirin.
You're welcome, Carol.
Can't wait to hear all of Shirin's stories this week. Meanwhile, you can see photos and read more of Shirin's reporting from Saudi Arabia at theworld.org. Chloe, Fendi, Chanel. Each of these famous fashion houses was influenced by the iconic German designer Karl Lagerfeld. With a mane of sleek white hair, angular dark sunglasses, and black suits, Lagerfeld was instantly recognizable. He died in Paris today at age 85. Alicia Drake is a writer and a biographer of Karl Lagerfeld.
When he first arrived in Paris in 1953, he was really set out for a very conventional career within haute couture. When he went into ready-to-wear, no one else was really looking at ready-to-wear. It was extremely daring. What he brought to Paris in the 70s was his extraordinary creativity, but also his amazing charisma.
You mentioned ready-to-wear as kind of a new territory. What were his signature designs for that?
What's interesting about Karl is he doesn't really have a signature design. He is able to put himself in the skin of whichever design house he goes into, and he was able to get the best out of that design house. So when he went into Chloe, what he was known for in the 70s was this most extraordinary, gorgeous, feminine, very floaty aesthetic. Then when he went to Chanel in the 1980s, you know, now we look at Chanel and it's so desirable, it's such a blockbuster, but that was not the case when Karl went there. It really was a dusty old couture house, and he made it sexy.
He had that signature look himself, you know, the white hair or a ponytail, you know.
Yep.
What was his personality like?
That look that we remember and that silhouette, the very skinny silhouette, was only in the last, say, 20 years, 15 years of his life. There have been other looks that Carl has sported. One thing that was consistent and constant with Carl is that he always liked to be seen, which worked perfectly in Paris. His personality was extremely extrovert. He loved to shock. In the 80s and the 90s, he used to be known for saying really outrageous things. That definitely softened.
But I think in recent years, he was also drawn to controversy, kind of controversial things about, you know, immigration, about, you know, body size and Me Too movement.
Right.
I mean, he kind of, you know, angered a lot of people. I mean, did he just like to be provocative?
I think he liked to be provocative. He was an insatiable gossip. He loved to gossip, and it was restricted within Paris circles, but nothing's restricted anymore. And so, of course, social media means, you know, you have more responsibility for what you say.
In your book, you spoke to a lot of people who are close to Karl Lagerfeld. What was it like to get to know him through his friends and business associates?
Well, first of all, I did meet him before I started writing the book, so I don't think I would have ever dared to try to take on the book without meeting Karl Lagerfeld. And really, it was a process of getting to know different strands of Carl. He was so powerful in Paris that obviously the way people spoke about him was with great deference. And it was interesting speaking to his sister, who was slightly older than him, or speaking to people he was at school with, who had charming childhood memories about him. For instance, one man in Bad Bramstedt who remembered that they would all be running around with sort of bare feet in the summer and wearing shorts and, you know, the sort of little German schoolboys. And Carl always, even then, he was curating his look, and he used to wear a jacket and a tie and be very formal.
Do you have a favorite Karl Lagerfeld anecdote?
Women's Wear Daily used to go to Chanel just before the show, and Carl would do a preview. And I was just a real total assistant, and I went along with the person who was interviewing him. I was really a nobody. And at one point, he was talking about the show, and then he, with about five lines with a pencil, he sketched what he was imagining. He sketched what he was talking about, and then he actually very sweetly handed the sketch to me. And I thought that was incredibly generous for a start, real generosity. But also what I loved was his ability to sketch what he imagined. He could bring what he imagined to life. And I think he did that with his life.
Alicia Drake is a writer, and she's also a biographer of Karl Lagerfeld. Thanks a lot, Alicia.
Thank you.
Recognize this sound? Lightsabers. Think Star Wars, the go-to weapons of Jedi.
Don't make me destroy you.
Now the lightsaber is joining the ranks of the foil and the épée. The French Fencing Federation has officially recognized lightsaber dueling as a competitive sport. Terry Birnbaum is the owner of the Saber Legion, the largest lightsaber combat organization in the world. So the only lightsabers I've seen are the ones my son had when he was like 8 years old.
Yeah.
So I'm imagining the ones you use in competition are a little bit stronger. Can you describe them?
Since then, they've come a long way with developing the sabers and whatnot. They use a polycarbonate plastic, which is the same grade as material they use for police batons and riot shields. And the hilts are made out of air-grade aluminum. So they can really take a beating.
So you still get the pew, pew, pew. You get the cool sounds, though, don't you?
Absolutely. The internals of the lightsabers have high-quality soundboards and speakers, so you get all that cool stuff.
Sounds expensive.
Yeah, you can get them from $60 to up to $2,000. So there's a huge market.
Terry, how did you get into this?
Initially, it was because of my love of Star Wars. And then that graduated to, you know, a love of sword arts. So I started studying different sword arts. And then I and a friend decided to kind of merge those two, and we came up with this. And so we took saber combat to the next level. What we do is full contact. We decided to just kind of up the ante on it.
What do you mean? Do you mean that you're actually like stabbing people with the lightsaber? I mean, describe how the actual game is played.
Absolutely. So in TSL, the Saber Legion, the rules are basically cuts and slashes and thrusts are all points. If you hit someone, you get a point. The first person to 10 points wins. And we don't allow certain moves. You can't thrust to the throat, and you can't thrust to the abdomen. And there's no groin shots whatsoever either. So everything else is fair game.
So how popular is this?
It's very popular. In the Sabre Legion, we have over 6,000 members worldwide. So all over the United States, Canada, Mexico, Australia. It's a growing sport. And there's other organizations as well that have a following too. So
Terry, what was your reaction when you heard about the announcement by the French?
My first reaction to that was awesome. You know, it's about time that people are, you know, seeing our sport and it's becoming legitimized. And having an organization like that come in and do what they did is making a lot of people happy, because what we do is a sport, and a lot of people have worked very hard to get the sport to where it's at.
So will you be going to France to compete?
Well, my dream is to have the Sabre Combat in the Olympics. So if Sabre Combat was ever in the Olympics, I'm totally up for that. Team USA all the way.
Terry Birnbaum is the owner of the Sabre Legion, the largest lightsaber combat organization in the world. Thanks a lot, Terry.
Thank you.
And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. May the Force be with you.